Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, July 6th, 2011. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Yellowstone River landowner tells of getting sick from oil. State Senator McGee won't release medical records after saying a concussion caused his bizarre behavior in mid-June. And police investigate 7 arson fires in Moscow that occurred Sunday night and early Monday morning, damaging dumpsters, garbage cans, and porta potties. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Moscow Police Chief David Duke says his agency is investigating a string of 7 arson fires set in parks, trash cans, and dumpsters during a 3-hour period late Sunday night and early Monday morning. Duke told the Lewiston Tribune the 7 fires were set deliberately by people. The first fire was reported at 10:13 p.m. Sunday in a trash can at Lyons Park at the Latah County Fairgrounds. Firefighters discovered another fire in a dumpster at the fairgrounds a half hour later. At 11:21, firefighters were called to a dumpster fire on Sweet Avenue. At 10 minutes after midnight, fire crews responded to a report of a tree fire at Anderson Frontier Park on West Palouse River Drive. The fire had been set in a porta potty, which was destroyed. Shortly after that, a neighbor was injured putting out a grass fire at Water Tower Park on East F Street. The neighbor was burned by melted plastic when he splashed water from his cooler onto the trash can where the fire was set. The neighbor managed to put out the fire before fire crews arrived and was treated at Gritman Hospital and released. Another dumpster fire was put out on the north side of Lena Whitmore Elementary School on South Blaine Street after being reported at 12:48 a.m. on Monday. A 7th fire was found to have been set in a trash can at Rotary Park earlier in the evening. That fire had burned itself out. Duke said anyone with information about the arsons can call the Moscow Police Department at 882-COPS, or they can call the anonymous tip line at 892-3898. A grizzly bear has killed a man hiking in the central part of Yellowstone Park near Canyon Village. Park officials are not releasing the name of the man or his hometown at this time. Today's grizzly attack is the first fatal bear mauling within the park since 1986, although 2 people were killed by grizzlies in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem last year. In today's attack, the man was walking with his wife on the Wapiti Lake Trail, and they apparently got between a mother grizzly bear and her cubs. Idaho Senate Majority Caucus Chair John McGee and his attorney have not responded to the Associated Press's request for McGee's medical records relating to a June 19th incident where he was found passed out in a vehicle owned by someone he didn't know. McGee had apparently driven the vehicle, towing a 20-foot trailer, for a distance in Boise after drinking at a golf course and had gotten stuck in a driveway while attempting to turn the vehicle around. Witnesses said it appeared McGee was hallucinating when they found him in the back seat of the vehicle. McGee was originally charged with a felony of taking a vehicle without the owner's permission, but in a plea bargain Friday, McGee pled guilty to driving under the influence and was sentenced to 180 days in jail with all but 5 days suspended. Driving under the influence is a misdemeanor. McGee will likely avoid any jail time because of 2 days served after his arrest and permission from the judge to perform 24 hours community service in lieu of 3 days jail time. McGee also was sentenced to mandated alcohol counseling and fined $1,000. McGee's attorney, Scott McKay, told a magistrate judge at Friday's sentencing that his client fell and struck his head while attending a golf tournament with his brother the night of June 18th. McKay said a respected neurologist who he did not name said McGee had likely suffered a concussion, which affected his behavior. The Associated Press immediately asked for McGee's medical records relating to the night of the incident. Prompt treatment for concussions is necessary because they can cause intracranial bleeding or seizures. In response to an inquiry by the Associated Press, Ada County Sheriff Gary Rainey released a statement saying, "All inmates booked in the Ada County Jail are screened by a medical professional and provided with appropriate medical treatment for injuries observed by medical staff or reported by the inmate. Between June 18th and June 21st, 2011, no inmate in the Ada County Jail reported or was diagnosed with a concussion or other closed head injury." House Minority Leader John Rushi of Lewiston, who is also a doctor, said if he indeed had a concussion, then the sheriff's department ought to review medical protocol. On the issue of McGee choosing not to release his medical records, Rushi said, "I don't believe that because you are an elected public official, you lose your right to medical privacy. When you assert that right to medical privacy, there's a consequence. That is, people may feel you are not being open about what happened." Malheur County, Oregon District Attorney Dan Norris, who handled McGee's case as a special prosecutor, said the head injury was an insignificant issue in his decision to drop the felony charge. He said the owner of the vehicle and the residents in whose driveway McGee got stuck did not want unwanted attention that would come about by prosecuting McGee for a felony. Norris said by the time of the plea deal, the victims had received apologies from McGee and compensation for property damage. Norris did say McGee appeared to have a recent head injury at the time of his arrest. Besides serving in the state Senate, McGee works as marketing director of West Valley Medical Center in Caldwell and is chair of the board of the College of Idaho. When he was head of the Senate Transportation Committee, he supported Governor Butch Otter's proposed Connecting Idaho multi-year highway construction program. Spokane police say a car found in the Spokane River near Mission Park today contains at least one body and belongs to one of three refugees from Bhutan missing since June 11th. 28-year-old Dilaram Bhattarya, 21-year-old Krishna Dital and 17-year-old Krishna Dakal have been missing. Dakal lives in Spokane, and Batare and Dital live in Tequila. Police had initially searched the area when missing persons reports were filed, but the river was 4 feet higher at the time of the disappearances. A Prosser, Washington man is in critical condition after a four-vehicle accident yesterday on U.S. 195 south of Colfax. 29-year-old Christopher Beaver was driving a 2006 Saturn, which was the last car hit in the chain reaction accident that started when a wheel came off a northbound horse trailer. Beaver was transported by helicopter to St. Joseph Regional Medical Center. Two other people in the crash suffered lesser injuries. Lewiston Fire Inspector Julian Sorrell says a firework likely started a fire that burned a wing of the Grace Evangelical Lutheran Church early Tuesday morning. Sorrell said an aerial firework landed on the roof of the church. A family, including three children, were sleeping in the church when the blaze started, but were evacuated before the fire got very large. The roof of the wing of the church caved in later. Spokane-based Avista Utilities will ask the Idaho Public Utilities Commission to approve a 3.7% increase in electrical rates for their customers in Idaho and a 3.5% increase in natural gas rates. Avista spokesperson Debbie Simak told the Spokesman Review the rate increases are needed to replace substations at Deary, Kellogg, and Coeur d'Alene and to upgrade two turbines at the Knoxon Rapids Dam. Those turbines were built in the 1950s. Simak also said the utility needs to upgrade the 82-year-old spill gates at the Nine Mile Dam. The rate increases would add $10.9 million in revenue for Avesta every year. The company has 122,000 electrical customers in Idaho and 74,000 natural gas customers. The Idaho Public Utilities Commission will be taking public comments on the proposal. For more information, you can go to www.puc.idaho.gov. Federal Judge B. Lynn Windmill issued a preliminary injunction blocking a new anti-union law from going into effect in Idaho. The law would have stopped unions from collecting dues to subsidize members' wages as a way of helping contractors who hire union workers win job bids. Windmill's decision acknowledges the union's lawsuit against the law would have a high probability of success because it appears to conflict with already existing federal labor rules. Windmill wrote in his ruling, "This creates a risk of conflicting rulings from the state court and the board, which and threatens state interference with the National Labor Relations Board's enforcement of national labor relations policy. This court has found that there exists a significant risk of overlapping jurisdiction between Idaho state courts and the National Labor Relations Board if the Fairness in Contracting Act becomes effective." Attorney James Piotrowski, who represented the Idaho Building and Construction Trades Council, AFL-CIO, and Southwest Building and Construction Trades Council, AFL-CIO, in the lawsuit, said, "Congress designed the NLRB to resolve the legality of job targeting programs, not state legislatures. There was a broad anti-federal sentiment in the legislature this year that was expressed in a lot of ways, one of which was in this law, which even the Attorney General told them was going to be problematic because it conflicted with federal law." Unions are also challenging another anti-labor law passed by the legislature, which prohibits project labor agreements, which require contractors to make agreements with union workers as a condition for winning government jobs. The unions did not ask for a preliminary injunction against that law. Workers are finding few animals harmed by the ExxonMobil oil pipeline spill into the Yellowstone River, but that doesn't mean they aren't there. Dwayne Titus of International Bird Rescue of California told the Billings Gazette, "It's hard with the high water. The banks are undercut and the river is way too swift. We are just trying to find any little access point, bike path, railroad track, or driveways right at the river. Every access point we can get out and go look." So far, Titus and five other members of his group have found some pelicans with oil on the tips of their wings. ExxonMobil says up to 42,000 gallons of crude oil may have leaked from the broken Silvertip pipeline that ruptured near Laurel. The pipeline carries crude from the northern Wyoming oil fields to the ExxonMobil refinery in Billings. Because eastern Montana has had heavy rains and high snowmelt runoff in the last month, the river is running fast. Already, crews in Williston, North Dakota are taking water samples to see if the oil is in the Yellowstone River there. Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks worker Bob Gibson, who was also along the riverbanks with five other workers just downstream from the ruptured oil pipeline, told the Billings Gazette, "We haven't found any evidence of floating fish or anything like that. It's hard to say because we really can't get to most of the river because of high water. We're not saying it's good. We're not saying it's bad. We haven't found anything substantive yet, but that doesn't mean it's not there." Montana State University ecology professor Al Zale said the impacts of the oil spill on the Yellowstone River ecosystem may not be apparent for a while. Zale said, "In the weeks and months ahead, we will be looking for any unusual changes in the river's natural environment and any impacts on the species of fish we would expect to find at this time of year. Some species or ages of fish may be more susceptible to this type of pollution than others." Democracy Now! Interviewed Alexis Banofsky, a family farmer who lives south of Billings, Montana, near the Blue Creek area along the Yellowstone River. She is also the Tribal Lands Senior Coordinator for the National Wildlife Federation. Bonagovsky said in the interview it took 3 full days to get any information from ExxonMobil or the government. She said she was not allowed inside a July 4th press conference with Exxon Pipeline Company President Gary Pressing held in Laurel because she was not accredited. She said Pressing met with her after the press conference, but she was not allowed to record the discussion. She also said she didn't hear the normal birds, insects, and wildlife when she walked her land along the Yellowstone River. Later in the weekend, she got sick.
I just got this overwhelming sense of nausea and dizziness, and I went back up fairly quickly, and I had a really bad headache, and my throat was swollen, and, I just felt really, really crappy, and I was going to just go lay down, but everyone made me go to the hospital, and the doctor diagnosed me with acute hydrocarbon exposure. So he told me I couldn't go near the oil after that. So I was sent home. There was nothing they could give me to clear out my system except for drinking lots of water. So I am now unable to go down to where the oil is on our property, and if I smell it at all, some of the symptoms come back fairly quickly, but, everyone, is exhausted and tired, and I think, I asked the doctor, I was like, well, why was I impacted and not my husband, and he said everyone was different, so if your system can only take so much, that's what you're going to experience, so people, everyone's going to have different reactions to it.
Do you feel comfortable drinking the water from your property?
We have been bringing in city water. We have a cistern on our house, so I've been comfortable drinking the city water, but I wouldn't drink out of my well water, and that's another problem is all of our livestock depends on our well water. So we need to get someone down here to test our water and make sure that it's not contaminated. So I wouldn't drink out of it, and I don't like my livestock drinking out of it, but I don't have any other choice right now.
What kind of promises, if any, has Exxon made to you in terms of helping to clean up what it sounds like pretty extensive damage to your property?
They keep telling us they're going to restore it back to normal, and I keep telling them that's impossible. The cleanup workers are great. They know what they're doing, but there's no way to get the oil completely out of our soil without removing the topsoil. They keep promising that they're not going to leave until everything is back to normal and that they will be here until every drop of oil is gone. And I hope that's true. I hope that they follow through. I mean, there are a lot of landowners who don't have people on their property right now helping them clean up, and I think the only reason we have people on our property right now is that we've been fairly persistent with talking to Exxon and making sure that they are down here. So I just worry that the spill is so extensive that all the landowners along the Yellowstone may not get the necessary attention that they need. And the thing with the Yellowstone is that the ecosystem extends further beyond the banks of the Yellowstone. We have so many wetlands that, are now flooded with oil that they can't actually see all the oil damage. They have to go on foot down the river to actually make sure that they're seeing all of the damage that has been done. And I'm skeptical that they will spend the time needed to make sure that the Yellowstone is back to a semblance of what it was.
That was Alexis Bonagovsky, a family farmer who lives south of Billings, Montana, near the Blue Creek area along the Yellowstone River. She is also the Tribal Land Senior Coordinator for the National Wildlife Federation. She was interviewed by Democracy Now! You can hear the entire 19-minute interview, which was not part of the regular Democracy Now! Broadcast, at the Democracy Now! Website. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow. An Associated Press investigation has found that residents of Libby, Montana have used 1,000 tons of asbestos-contaminated wood chips that covered part of the defunct Stimson lumber mill site outside of town, and another 15,000 tons of the wood chips have been sold out of town. The AP investigation found the Environmental Protection Agency knew the wood chips were contaminated for 3 years, but did not ban their use until the AP investigation began in March of this year. The chips came from 76 million board feet of timber harvested from 9,000 acres of land near the W.R. Grace vermiculite mine, which produced asbestos-contaminated insulation for decades, sickening at least 1,750 current and former Libby residents. An estimated 400 people have died from asbestos-related diseases caused by the vermiculite mine, and most of those who have asbestosis or mesothelioma now will eventually die slow, painful deaths. Libby residents have been hauling away the wood chips by the truckload for landscaping and erosion control, meaning the town in which the EPA has already spent $370 million cleaning up may have been contaminated again. The AP obtained EPA documents that showed asbestos fibers in 4 out of 20 samples taken from the wood pile in 2007. University of Montana researcher Tony Ward said, "We're talking about millions of fibers per square centimeter of bark surface area. The question is, what is the dangerous level? There's a lot of people sick up there, and you can't argue with that. Theoretically, it takes just one fiber to get sick." U.S. Senator Max Baucus of Montana yesterday promised to launch an investigation into the wood chips and what the EPA knew about them. Some of the wood chips were sold to Eureka Pellet Mills, which rejected them as unsuitable. The AP was unable to verify a report that the wood chips then went to wood-burning power plants in Canada. The EPA says it no longer has jurisdiction over the wood chips that were sold because it's now classified as a commercial product. The agency has told Libby residents, however, not to move the wood chips they use for landscaping and erosion control while they are dry so as not to stir up asbestos fibers. The local Libby official who was selling the wood chips, Paul Rummelhart, told the Associated Press, "I've got a file that's 3 feet thick on all the sampling that's going on. If you have a few hits, so what?" Referring to the many asbestos victims in town, Rummelhart said he's, quote, "sick and tired of those victims." Rummelhart says the issue has hurt the town's efforts at economic recovery and said he intends to sell the rest of the wood chips, which cover several acres at the Stimson Lumber Mill site, if he has the chance. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, mostly clear, low 51 tonight, mostly sunny tomorrow, high 85. A 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms before midnight Thursday night, otherwise mostly cloudy, low 49. West winds 15 to 20, gusts up to 30. Sunny, high 72 on Friday. West winds 15 miles an hour, gusts up to 25. Clear, low 44 Friday night. West winds 15 miles an hour with gusts up to 25, decreasing overnight. And clear to mostly clear conditions Saturday through Tuesday of next week. High 75 Saturday, around 80 Sunday and Monday. Currently, we have 85 degrees in the Moscow Pullman area. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. Remember, if you want to help KRFP keep reports like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, the public affairs shows, and the recordings of local events, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $25 for students. You can send your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or check us out on the web. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. Building Bridges, the weekly labor show from Pacifica Radio, is up next, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica, and then music from Alan Solon at around 7:30. KRFP Moscow.